Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does today's Texas tell us about the makeup of the state in decades to come? And how will changes in who lives here affect how we all live? In 1997, then-state demographer Steve H. Murdoch was the lead author of a census-informed book that looked at our failure to foster conditions in which minority residents attained as much education or earned as much money on average as their Anglo neighbors. Nearly two decades later, Texas is now a majority minority state whose future prosperity could be in peril unless we find ways to expand socioeconomic mobility among Black and Latino residents in particular. Steve Murdoch is now Allen and Gladys Klein Professor of Sociology and Director of the Hobby Center for the Study of Texas at Rice University. His new book, written with Michael E. Klein, Mary Zay, Wilner Genty, and Deborah Perez, is called Changing Texas: Implications of Addressing or Ignoring the Texas Challenge. Steve, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What is the Texas Challenge exactly, and what data did you use to identify it in the first place?
Well, the Texas Challenge is really the work we've done looking at the Texas changing the population change in terms of the characteristics. And the challenge is to ensure that all Texans have the skills and education they need to be competitive in what is increasingly, of course, international society. That competitiveness is the difference of between a richer Texas future or a poorer future for Texas.
So for this project, you're looking several decades into the future. What can we expect the population of the state to look like in 2050?
Pardon?
What will the population of Texas look like in 2050?
Well, in 2050, we're looking at a state population that would be about 55 million people, up from the 26.3 or so that we have now in terms of our total population. We would be looking at a population that is about 50% Hispanic, about 56% Hispanic, about 22% non-Hispanic white, about 10% African American, and about 13% non-Hispanic Asian and other. That's compares with one in our most recent census that was 45% non-Hispanic white, about 12% non-Hispanic black, about 38% Hispanic, and about 6% non-Hispanic Asian and other.
So more than doubling the overall population. How does that compare with what's expected for other states in the U.S.?
Well, certainly we have been the fastest growing state now for over a decade and a half. We were the fastest growing state in numerical terms in the 2000 to 2010 period. We've been the fastest growing in numerical terms since 2000. The most recent data we have is through 2013. And so it's been a long period of growth. In fact, if you compare us to the country, in every period of time since we joined the Union as a state, we have grown more rapidly than the country as a whole. So rapid growth and extensive growth has been part of Texas history since the beginning.
How much of that growth these days is due to migration from other states or countries, and how much comes from people already living here starting families?
Well, our growth has been historically, all the way through the last decade, through 2010, we were about, and for several decades, have been about 50% natural increase. That's that excess of births over deaths as a result of births, in other words, in terms of growth. The other half of our growth was for migration, and if you took that 50%, half of that was domestic migration, so about 25% of our total growth was migration from other states, and half of it was immigration. Now, the most recent data changed that a little, but not as much as people think. Still about half of our growth is natural increase, and it's now about 20% from the other part of that, or the other half, about 20% of our total growth is now domestic, is international migration. About 30% is domestic migration, meaning migration from other states.
Do the data suggest anything about why people come here in greater numbers than to other states with, say, similar climates or economic prospects?
Well, there's certainly data, not necessarily in the demographic, purely demographic realm, that suggests, of course, that employment in one form or another, and in fact, whether it's immigration or domestic migration, employment is a big factor in that.
Mm-hmm. You have observed some stark differences in outcomes for Texas residents that appear to be tied to race and ethnicity. Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, one of the things that has been true for some time are there's vast differences in income. For example, if you look at income for African Americans and Hispanics in Texas, they're, depending on the area, between 60 and 75% of what the incomes are for non-Hispanic whites. Poverty rates are 2 to 3 times as high, depending on the area that you're looking in. And I think the thing that many of us that study this believe is that one of the factors in that is education. And so when you look at educational differences, those are very, very large indeed. So when you look at the state, for example, as a whole in 2010. Whereas about 8% of non-Hispanic whites had less than high school level of education, over 40% of Hispanics had less than high school level of education, and that's true. That's true in Dallas. It's true in Houston. It's true in San Antonio. It's true in Austin. It's true across the state. It's a very pervasive difference, and the reason that we concentrate on education is that education has been historically the single best predictor of socioeconomic resources. Education and prosperity go together, at least in a general sense, in the United States as well as Texas.
And even now, the percentage of people living in Texas who have college degrees is on the decline.
Not the the percentage, yes, but the percentage is because of the composition of the population. Mm-hmm. It's not that the people that are here, for example, we have increases in education for all racial and ethnic groups, but because we're getting larger increases in those population bases that have lower levels of education, when you kind of add those all together, the net result is to over time decrease educational levels.
So what have you surmised about the best ways to improve educational outcomes for groups that historically have not attained as much education as others?
Well, I think opportunity is a big part of that, and I think we're doing our best to try to provide that. I think there are some things that we know help children, particularly children who may have language issues or who may have issues in terms of simply the resources, for example, that a middle-class kid might have, many poor kids do not have. And one of the things that the literature shows very clearly is that early childhood education, and we're not talking about kindergarten, we're talking about before that, has been found in analysis across the country to be one of the great levelers of socioeconomic achievement, and it certainly would help. It is clear as well when you begin to look at our higher education system that at least in the last few years, and admittedly some of that is a function, if you will, of the downturn in the economy that was experienced in Texas and elsewhere, we're simply not funding at the level. If you took the 2000 to 2010 period of time, for example, and you looked at it in terms of a per-student basis, the total real increase for elementary and secondary schools was about 4%. There was actually, on a per-student basis, in terms of, now this is state appropriations, about a 20% decline for higher education in Texas.
So are you able to identify what those declines mean students go without?
Well, I mean, I think it impacts a lot of different things. It impacts the ability that colleges and universities have to give grants and aids. It affects the amount that you can pay teachers, and hence the amount that you can get in terms of the level of skills and so forth in your teaching body. It'll affect all aspects from the buildings that you build to the most importantly student-teacher ratios, the number of resources that you can put in the classroom to help children learn.
So what accounts, Steve, for the fact that, let's assume if we're looking at all public school students in the state of all races and backgrounds, that, say, white middle-class students continue to do better than their brown and black peers when theoretically every student at least should be receiving the same per capita expenditures?
Well, much of that is they don't come in with the same knowledge base. In other words, mm-hmm. they come in many with much more preschool education. They often come from parents who are well-educated and hence are teaching them things when they're, very young. They probably went to a very good kindergarten. Many across the state now, you find that people with more resources, whatever their racial and ethnic group, are getting their kids into preschool, recognizing that that provides a distinct advantage. If, on the other hand, you're a poor kid, you have parents who have minimal English language skills, those children are probably going to have their first experience in education when they reach kindergarten, and even then they may have their own language difficulties and other factors. So it isn't that, and there's nothing about this, by the way, that is due to racial and ethnic characteristics in and of themselves. It is that due to a variety of historical, discriminatory, and other factors, these demographic characteristics are tied to socioeconomic characteristics. They have been historically. They're not, it's not just in Texas. It is across the country.
How long do those bumps of high-quality early childhood education last for students? Can the effects still be sort of quantified 10 years later?
Oh yeah, I mean, in terms of the effects, they're really throughout the educational experience of the children, and especially in terms of their ability to be competitive in those first few grades, to learn at the level that other students are learning, etc. So it has a lasting effect in one very important sense, is that if a student gets behind in the second or third grade, and is not reading at level, is got deficiency in math skills, etc. It becomes more difficult to catch up, and many of these children simply will not catch up. They'll end up dropping out.
Have you seen evidence that other states that spent less than the national average on public school funding have changed that, and therefore had better outcomes over time? And how long would that take?
Yeah. I haven't studied other states extensively. There are states that put greater emphasis on early childhood education, and it is important to understand that when you look at us in a total sense educationally, we have some of the more negative overall characteristics. For example, we have generally ranked absolutely last in terms of the percent of adults with a high school level of education. So that it's not just one or two factors, it is a whole set of factors that has impacted things. And it includes, for example, we rank 46th in a recent set of data in the percent of our high school teachers that were teaching with a major in their main teaching assignment area. We have, we're 12th, as you know, in poverty level. We're 10th in terms of child poverty. We're 41st in percent of 18 to 24-year-olds that are enrolled in colleges and universities. Mm. So there are a whole set of these factors that we struggle with. While at the same time, we're first in terms of Hispanic student enrollment growth, first in terms of total enrollment growth.
My guest, let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Steve H. Murdoch, author of the new book, Changing Texas, Implications of Addressing or Ignoring the Texas Challenge.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former Texas State demographer Steve H. Murdoch, currently Allen and Gladys Klein Professor of Sociology and Director of the Hobby Center for the Study of Texas at Rice University. He's lead author of the new book, Changing Texas, Implications of Addressing or Ignoring the Texas Challenge. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, sending email to think at kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Steve, clearly, based on what you've been telling us, school really matters, educational attainment matters. Do we measure the educational attainment reported by immigrants from other countries in exactly the same way that we would record and report educational attainment within this country?
Well, there would be certainly our differences in that. I think that, you know, we're putting a lot of emphasis in this discussion on the problems that we have with lack of education. I think the other thing to understand, what's very important and a very important part of our book, is to explain the advantages that can come to us if we meet this educational challenge. I mean, they are substantial. The work we did, for example, indicates that if we could close the gaps between minority children and non-Hispanic white children, you know, looking into 2050, the difference could be between reducing from 2010 our per capita income from to $3,000 per person to increasing it by $24,000 per person. It could mean you know, an increase in average income, almost doubling it from $66,000 to about $132,000. It could be an increase in consumer expenditures. It could mean that our poverty rate, which was about 17.8% in 2010, could be as low as 11.9%. 17.9% or 17.8% or would be in 2050. It could be as low as 12%. So there is a lot of advantages. It isn't just that education is there and it's important to help children who need additional help, but the important part, and a very important part as well, and what we point out, is that we can take a disadvantage and turn it into an advantage for Texas, because we'll be a younger, growing state when many other states are experiencing difficulties in terms of a aging population with relatively few, compared to historical averages, numbers of young people.
Yeah, let's talk about the advantages, potential advantages of this very large youth population that Texas has and is projected to continue to have. This means that there is a vibrant workforce even as older folks begin to retire.
Absolutely. We have, you know, one of the younger populations in the country. And if you look, for example, at many of the areas that are having slow population growth, and perhaps a good example of that in a very aggregate sense, is if you look at the northeastern and midwestern parts of the United States, those are the slowest growing areas. They're growing, depending on the area, from a third to a fourth as fast as areas in the south and in the western part of the United States. Much of that slower growth is a result of decreases in the number of children. Now, decreases in numbers of children is not just those two regions. It is increasingly a national phenomena. But in areas that have the diversity that we have, or California has, or Arizona, or many other parts of the South and West, you're seeing a much less dramatic aging of the population.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join this discussion by sending email to think at kera.org or sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Talk about the ways that businesses are looking at these data and trying to project what Texas might look like and making decisions about how and whether to invest in Texas for the future.
Well, I think that many businesses certainly are looking at Texas as in relationship to business in several ways. One is they do see our young population. They see as well in Texas, if you will, a laboratory for what the country will be like. You know, one of the statistics I like to quote that gives people an idea of that is if you took from 2000 to 2010, only 11% of the growth in Texas in a net sense was due to non-Hispanic whites. Okay, mm-hmm. About 65% was due to the Hispanic population. In the United States, the percent due to non-Hispanic whites was 8%. Mm-hmm. It was less than in Texas. So that when you start looking at a diverse Texas, it is just a it's a preview of the increasingly diverse nation. So that, for example, the Census Bureau projects that by 2042 there will be no single racial and ethnic group that will make up 50% or more of the U.S. population. So not as rapid a change as we're seeing in places like Texas or California or Florida, all of which, by the way, are growing faster than most other large states, but that we're also seeing in those, that vibrant young population that is really America's future.
Is it possible that these changes in demographics over time could also lead to a shift in political control in the state?
Well, yeah, that's possible, and I'm often asked that question. It is difficult to know exactly when. For example, people often focus on the Hispanic population, which of course is the fastest growing, and as we saw from the data that we talked about earlier, would be a large part of our population going forward. But if you look at, for example, in terms of for example, when would Hispanics become a majority of the population? That would probably be somewhere between, depending on our rate of growth, 2030 and 2040, probably closer to 2040. Certainly, they could, in conjunction with African Americans and others, be a dominant group in the sense that non-Hispanic whites would be somewhere between 25 and 35% of the population in those same periods of time. But a lot of it depends, of course, not only on the demographics, but on registration, voter turnout, citizenship, et cetera, that all affect your eligibility to vote.
And, of course, parties themselves do change their priorities over time and may appeal in different ways to different groups of people. We shouldn't assume that they're fixed where they are now either.
Absolutely not. Parties do change as populations change as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Tony in DeSoto. Hey, Tony.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
You kind of stole my thunder because my question was, if we know these are facts, why haven't the policies been put in place to deal with this? We have a conservative political party here who knows these are going to happen. You know, the bulk of the population don't know this. The people they're going after, they don't know it. But these political people, from the top of the governor to everybody down in Austin, know these facts are coming.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Tony. Do you feel, Steve, like policymakers are paying attention to this work you're doing?
Oh, well, I think so. We've seen a number of programs over the years that have been based in it. For example, a major program that's just wrapping up its first phase in higher education, the Closing the Gaps program, was a program intended to help increase the number of minority children that were graduating from schools. The Texas Grants Program that was created by Senator Ellis, in fact, from the city in which I'm sitting right now, has provided lots of money for kids of all racial and ethnic groups to go to college, and that was funded by the Texas Legislature. So we've done some things. I think many of us would wished it had been more, but certainly people have listened to the demographics, and they know, I mean, every one of them knows in their districts that with a very, very few exceptions, the demographics that we talk about in the first part of our book are the demographics of Texas.
Is it possible to identify whether there is more bang for the buck to be had from something like, say, early childhood education or an improvement in the K-12 system, or would we be better off investing more and more wisely in the university system?
Well, you know, in a sense, it's all three. But certainly in terms of the data that I know, in terms of closing the gaps, in terms of making kids competitive, because if they don't get through grade school with a good education, they were very unlikely to do very well in high school, very unlikely then to go on and sometimes finish high school, but certainly to finish college. So I think most of the analysis suggests that those early childhood years, coupled with, you know, the early grades, are a make or break for most students. Yes, there are students that come back from those, but in many ways and in many cases, those students' fates get sealed very early in their educational career.
How evenly distributed are these changes that you've described across different regions of the state?
Well, I'm not sure I know all the regional differences, but I think that in terms of certainly, you know, our largest proportions of Hispanics still are in South Texas, El Paso, Laredo, McAllen, Edinburgh, Mission, etc., San Antonio. But increasingly, they are a statewide phenomenon. One figure that I like to give people when I do presentations is to ask them the question, say, we have three of the 10 largest cities. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, Houston at number 4, San Antonio at number 7, Dallas at number 9. What do you think the percent of non-Hispanic white children are in each of those three? And in which one of those do you think has the largest proportion of its children that are non-Hispanic white? Well, nearly all of these, the guess is that it's either Dallas or Houston. But the reality is this, in 2010, in the city of Dallas, 14.5% of children, this is a city now, 14.5% of children were non-Hispanic white. In Houston, it was 14.6%. In San Antonio, it was 16.9%. So, I mean, the answer is that it's very low in all of them. And, of course, if you were to do it relative, San Antonio actually has the largest proportion of its children who are non-Hispanic white. So it's a very pervasive phenomena. And so as you go across the state, increasingly, yes, there are small areas that may be much, much less diverse. But as a whole, Texas is diverse, and it is a pervasive phenomena across the state.
And for people who say, well, I'm doing okay, I'm, you know, giving my kids a good education, ultimately it's going to affect all of us if this state becomes either richer or poorer.
Certainly. If you look at our state and we become less competitive because we have a workforce that is less in demand because it is less well-educated, if we become a state where resources that we put into other factors are not put into infrastructure, into other kinds of things that make our cities and towns better to live in, we will over time have a difficulty in attracting people to the same extent in the same ways that we do now. And so it is not, you know, just certain people that will be disadvantaged if we don't change the socioeconomics that go with our demographics. It will become a problem for the state as a whole and for areas within the state.
Are rural and urban sections of Texas affected equally by the data that you examine here? And will Texas essentially be even more urban moving into the future?
Well, most of the country is increasingly urban. When you look at Texas, we have a set of demographics that have unfortunately been the same for a long period of time, and that is if you look at West Texas, Panhandle on down through West Texas, you'll find that most of the counties that in our state that are declining are in that region of the state, and we have a number of counties that continue to have problems with growth. For example, 2000 to 2010, we had 79 counties. And then by 2012, we had 96 of our 254 counties that were declining. But to give you a direct answer to your question, even in those states those counties where there was decline, there was also an increased racial and ethnic diversity taking place at the same time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone next to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. I just really want to say I'm really glad you're doing the show because the conversation around education in just about everywhere seems to always be based on two pillars. And one of those is that we seem to believe that the problem is the teachers and the answer is the test. And this really broadens the conversation and bring some meat and potatoes to the table to discuss about, the future of Texas. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And any comments that generates?
Thanks for going.
Thanks.
Do you want to respond to that, Steve?
Well, I appreciate him recognizing that. And having been from a family of teachers, I certainly agree that the challenges, I think, to teachers are great these days. And we have many fine teachers in Texas that are doing their best to address what we call the Texas Challenge.
I wonder, over the course of your career, how improvements in technology have made it easier to sort of crunch these numbers, discern patterns within the data. Is it an easier job now than it was, say, 30 years ago?
Well, it is easier, certainly in the sense of the ease with which one can do an analysis and with one statistical technique or another. Simply our ability to handle data. I tell people, for example, the first census I was involved in, a key way was in 1980, and we literally had rooms full of census tapes to cover Texas. And when you had the printed reports, you could take a fairly good-sized room, 30 by 30, and you would have printed documents that would cover every inch wall space.
Wow.
Now, of course, I can put those on a pile on various medias. If I wanted a media, like floppy disks even, but going back to more modern media, I could put those on my desk. And I would never do so because I'd store them in the cloud. I'd store them offline and access them as they were needed. So it has certainly made accessing these data, and it makes the ability to do things more quickly possible. The actual analysis where you have to look at the data, analyze the data, think through what you're finding, that part is probably limited more by simply the ability of we humans to do that kind of work than it is the technology. But technology certainly...
Got to jump in really quick. Have another quick break here. Steve H. Murdoch is my guest. His new book is called Changing Texas.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Steve H. Murdoch. He's Allen and Gladys Klein Professor of Sociology and Director of the Hobby Center for the Study of Texas at Rice University. He's also former state demographer of Texas and lead author of the new book, Changing Texas, Implications of Addressing or Ignoring the Texas Challenge. You were saying before the break, Steve, that the one thing that hasn't really changed is the human sort of creativity and analysis that needs to go into understanding what to make of these data.
Yes, I mean, we have lots of very young, bright, and very well-educated people. They do a good job in terms of the work we do, but simply it still takes time to look at the data, to understand the data, to see the relationships that exist between various factors. So the human element is certainly a critical part. Our technology has not taken that away from the equation that is necessary to do this kind of analysis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Margaret in Hearst. Hi, Margaret.
Yes, I was wondering, of the millennial generation myself, and during the election, from personal experience, I realized that the polling numbers were very inconsistent with what I noticed. And I wondered if in your research, it occurred to me that I didn't know anyone who actually had a landline, and that was how they do much of their polling. I wondered if you could shed light on that process and how that figures into your research, how you go around that particular situation, such as, polling younger members of the public.
Yeah. Well, our research is not based primarily on polling. It is to a great extent on data from agencies and organizations to collect data as people are involved in programs, and from the census. And the census is not primarily a phone interview process. It is it has the phone interview process, but it has a repeated set of contacts with people. So unlike the kind of one that the poll that you might get, somebody calls you up, and if you're not there, they go on to the next person. In the census process, they have a very complete, complex process of multiple contacts to their samples, very careful sampling. The Census Bureau and the BLS together employ nearly all of the, or a great majority, should say, large majority of all of the statisticians. But the collection of data is done not only with telephones, but to a great extent with mail surveys, and then with extensive follow-up. For example, in the census, the actual census, the decennial census, they'll contact, they'll go to each and every household five different times, and then the sixth time, in order to get basic data, like how many people there are and so forth, they'll actually go to the neighbor next door and say, well, who lives there, not necessarily expecting their names, but are there two adults, or et cetera, et cetera. And our other data that we use is agency data, so it's the actual number of people that are enrolled in education, the actual number of people that are enrolled in a variety of programs that are run by the state of Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Putter in Dallas. Hi, Putter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. I guess I'm wondering what you categorize or who you categorize as a non-Hispanic. White. I've heard that term used a number of times, but I've never heard you use the term Hispanic white. So how does that break down?
Well, first of all, let me say that in terms of the categories, all of those are based on self-identification. So that, for example, in the census and any related data that we use the categories that are based on people saying what they are. And so we don't go around and say, well, you're Hispanic and you're non-Hispanic white or Anglo, et cetera. But non-Hispanic white, for example, are people who say that their race is white and they are not Hispanic. They identify themselves in both categories, so then they're non-Hispanic white. So the identification, the categories are ones where ethnicity is either Hispanic or not Hispanic, and race is white, black, Asian, etc.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Bob in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
I'd like to get your guest comment on the following. I've worked with the Hispanic population in the Dallas area pretty closely for the last 10 years, and my assumption is that this is a significantly upward mobile population. It's the hardest working population we have in our state, or probably in the country, and their dedication to the education of their children is a defined one. Definable one. I believe, therefore, that when you begin to look out into the 2030 and beyond kind of range that your guest spoke of, that this population will be not necessarily looking for the government to do more for them, but there will be genuine taxpayers and looking for the government to lighten the load, if you will, as opposed to the assumption that they will be looking for more government services.
Well, I think we got your point, and it's an interesting one to consider, Bob, so thanks for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Steve?
No, I think only that to say that I think, yes, many of our population groups, as he's saying about Hispanics, are coming to the United States, if they're international immigrants, with the same desires that the Irish came or the Germans came or the Italians came, with a desire to not only be part of American society, but to be successful in American society. And they're showing the same kind of work ethic, et cetera, that many of our great-grandfathers and grandmothers did in terms of our own backgrounds.
And as a percentage of the Latino or Hispanic population, the number of people who are getting college degrees is growing. Is that right? But the overall population is also growing.
Yes, that both of those are correct. and the growth, and that's, this is true of any population, if you take a population that has more resources and hence has had more opportunities to seek educational opportunities early in their years of life, and get assistance along the way, will, for people with greater resources, there'll be more opportunities to improve their educational enhancement. And so you get with new populations, as you do with immigrants historically, you'll have they'll have more difficulty in getting those levels of education, but their desire to have it is certainly there. I think one of the things that I always use as an indicator of this is you see the same kind of language issues and the same kind of mastery of English taking place with these populations as you see with earlier populations. And that history, whether you're talking about Hispanics now or the Irish 150 years ago or et cetera, is a first generation knows primarily the language from the country with which they came, from which they came. The second generation knows both and needs to know both to communicate with their parents, primarily in the language and the country from which they came, and they need to communicate with the new society that they're part of. The third generation often does not know the language that their parents, the country from which their parents came, and so I see this across Texas in some of the areas of Texas that are most Hispanic in the sense of long and have multiple generations of Hispanics in this country, often have a smaller proportions of Hispanics that speak Spanish than is true in other areas.
So certainly there are many people who think that diversity within a state and immigration to a state can be very positive factors. For those who disagree with that, that think that we would perhaps be a stronger place if we limited immigration and particularly illegal immigration from other countries, what do we know about how different the population projections would be if somehow overnight no one was able to come into Texas and move here from another country?
Well, certainly it would reduce our growth. It would exactly how much is difficult because we don't have exact measurements on undocumented immigration. Although what we do know is that it is generally less than many people think. In Texas, there are several groups that do this. One of the do estimates of this, one of the ones that does a very good job of this is the Pew Hispanic Center out of D.C. But it happens that the person who actually does their estimates of undocumented immigrants is a demographer born and raised in Texas. And he estimates about 1.8 million undocumented, 1.8 million in Texas, somewhere between 10 to 12 million in the country as a whole. And when I ask him, I've often said to him, well, how do you know that there are not 20 million? I hear estimates of 20 or 25 million. His answer is that, you know, there is one thing you cannot hide, and that is dying. And he said, if there's really 20 or 25 million undocumented persons and not the 10 to the 13 or 14 million that some of our estimates suggest, then these are the healthiest group of people who have ever walked the face of the earth, because they die not at a level of 20 or 25 million, but a level of 10 to 13 million.
That's a really interesting way to sort of prove out those statistics one way or another.
Yes, that's very convincing to me, at least.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Margie in Granbury. Hi, Margie. Margie, are you with us? Okay, I don't think we have Margie on the line. Let's go on the phone instead to Don in Garland. Hi, Don.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
I was a teacher in Dallas for about 15 years. And I had quite the demographics out there were mainly Hispanic, and I noticed that we had a very small PTA, and a lot of parents where there might be one parent at home,
mm-hmm.
and there was a very small PTA involvement. Also, I had kids that I wanted to get. See them in the special programs where they could go to another school,
mm-hmm.
to get, like in I live in Garland, we have a a program where kids have to qualify to get into these different schools,
right.
And they're set up for that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I put it forth to some of the kids, it was mainly girls. They said that their parents didn't want them to get on a bus and go out of the neighborhood.
Well, I'm not sure if any of your studies can reflect on
well,
those
we haven't
experiences.
Looked at that kind of thing specifically. Certainly, one of the factors that we know that inhibits people's involvement in civic kinds of things or school kinds of things is language capabilities. And we know that people that are middle-class occupations are much more likely to be involved in their schools, no matter what racial and ethnic group they're from, than are people who work in manual labor and those kind of occupations.
So we've talked about the importance of a solid education system. We've talked a little bit about infrastructure. Can you talk about some of the other things that you think are important to change Texas in a positive manner as we look forward to the demographic projections of 2050?
Well, I think you mentioned what I think probably is the most important in terms of our educational system. I think we need to continue to ensure that we provide the kind of employment opportunities and the kind of growth in employment that we've had in many of the last few years. And I think that we need to ensure that we continue to keep our doors open, both literally and figuratively, to all people from all racial and ethnic groups. Because, you know, the bottom line that we are saying in our book is this, and that is how well they do, whoever you want to define they as, whether it's minorities, it's persons, majorities, it's whoever you want they to be, how well they do. But in particular, as we look at Texas' future, how well minorities do is going to be how well Texas does. And so inclusiveness and ensuring that everyone has access to the opportunities and skills to be competitive is important to them, but it's also important to the future of Texas.
Do you imagine a culture in Texas changing to the extent that everybody understands that they affects us?
I think we're seeing more of that over time. I don't expect it to be something that is absolutely pervasive everywhere all of the time. But I can tell you from 30 years ago when we would talk about these issues and the majority of the crowd would tell me that I was wrong, that this just wasn't happening. I don't have that same kind of response today. Hmm. I have a lot larger number of adults of all racial and ethnic groups that come up and say, you know, I see this issue in my town. I see it in my school. I see it in my business. We recognize in my business, for example, that we've had to change the mix of products to be attractive to a larger diversity of population, et cetera. The private sector seems to, in many ways, catch on to this quicker than the public sector.
Got to jump in now. The end of the show is here. Yeah. Steve H. Murdoch is author of the new book, Changing Texas, Implications of Addressing or Ignoring the Texas Challenge. Steve, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.